Welcome to today's program titled, How and Why California is Different When It Comes to Trade Secrets and Non-Competes. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, type your question, and click send. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read out loud during the presentation, and it will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form that was sent with the login information email. When you hear it, please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Robert Milligan, Josh Salinas, and Jim McNary. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Robert Milligan. I'm the co-chair of our Trade Secrets, Non-Compete, and Computer Fraud Practice Group. I'm joined by my two fellow co-presenters, Jim McNary, who's a partner in our Sacramento office and is also a member of the Trade Secrets, Non-Compete, and Computer Fraud Group, as well as Joshua Salinas, who's an attorney in our Century City office of Seyfarth Shaw, and his practice specializes in trade secrets, non-compete, and computer fraud issues. In fact, the three of us spend a fair amount of our practice dealing with the very topic of today's webinar, which is how and why California is different when it comes to trade secrets and non-competes. At a general level, how California is different from other jurisdictions when it comes to trade secrets and non-competes. In general, it all emanates from California's adoption of Business and Professions Code 16600, which in general strictly scrutinizes any sort of restrictive covenants that you may ask an employee to sign in connection with their employment. California has also adopted the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, but its adoption of the act, as well as the case law construing the act, also position California as unique compared to other jurisdictions. Many other jurisdictions allow non-compete agreements, restrictive covenant type of agreements, non-solicitation of customer type agreements. And in California, it stands as an exception to some of the general rules that apply across the country. On the trade secret side, having litigated and our panel having litigated a number of these trade secret cases on the defense as well as on the plaintiff's side, California is also a unique jurisdiction because courts really do scrutinize trade secret claims that are brought, and there's also the backdrop of sanctions and fees if a trade secret claim is brought in bad faith. So what we hope to do in this webinar today is to educate you about some of the nuances of California trade secret and non-compete law, as well as bring you up to date on some of the latest developments and the latest cases. There have been some interesting new cases that have come out, and so we hope that you will get an update on some of those developments. As far as what we'll cover, we have a bit of an ambitious agenda. We're going to talk a little bit about the definition of a trade secret, how California's adoption of the definition of a trade secret, and then two recent cases making it clear that ideas are protectable under the trade secret law, and also a very important case that's been getting a lot of media attention about how social media contacts, specifically LinkedIn connections, may be protectable as trade secrets. We're also going to discuss threatened misappropriation versus inevitable disclosure. And that often comes up when you're pursuing a trade secret case and you want to obtain an injunction and you want to argue that the person is using your trade secrets. Now, California has rejected the inevitable disclosure doctrine, but it does have a doctrine called threatened misappropriation, and we'll get into some of the nuances of that and how that can aid a company that's trying to pursue a trade secret misappropriation claim. And as I said, you know, trade secret claims in California, there's a lot of scrutiny, there's a lot of procedural requirements, and Josh and Jim will get into some of those procedural requirements. One of the requirements that makes California unique is that you actually have to do a trade secret designation prior to the commencement of discovery. You have to identify your trade secrets with particularity before you're allowed to commence discovery, which is unique. We'll also talk about an emerging and very important doctrine that's gaining a tremendous amount of traction in the state and federal courts in California, and that is preemption. And many people are familiar with preemption, but essentially preemption says that if you're dealing with a lawsuit that involves the theft of information, that you may be precluded from bringing claims apart from breach of contract and apart from trade secret misappropriation. So common claims such as unfair competition, tortious interference, breach of duty of loyalty, under this preemption doctrine, the courts have found that there may be limitations and you may be prohibited altogether from bringing those claims. And California has been one of the leading jurisdictions in developing a robust preemption doctrine. So we'll get a little bit into that. We're also going to cover some recent cases that have come up in the bad faith realm. And so oftentimes clients will come in and they want to do something about an employee that's left or they want to do something about a competitor, and there's a dearth of evidence. And these new cases explain that you have to be very careful before pursuing a trade secret claim lest you be sanctioned and get a bad faith attorney's award, because under the statute in California, if a trade secret claim is brought in bad faith, attorney's fees and costs are recoverable. And then we're also going to get finally into a discussion of non-compete agreements, non-solicitation agreements, discuss some recent cases in that regard, and also discuss this emerging concept of using forum and selection clauses in your restrictive covenant agreements. And then lastly, we'll give you a little bit on using restrictive covenants in business deals. We all will be having another webinar the beginning of December that'll get into that in much more detail, but we wanted to give you a taste of some recent California cases that are important in that regard. With that, I will turn it over to Joshua Salinas, who will explain California's adoption of the Uniform Trade Secret Act, and specifically what California has defined as a trade secret.
Thanks, Robert. So California has its trade secret definition codified in the California Uniform Trade Secrets Act. There's about 48 states, I believe, now that have either adopted some version of the adopted the UTSA or some modified version of the UTSA. And so under California law, there's four primary elements, four primary requirements for establishing a trade secret. One, information. Two, it's not generally known. Three, it derives independent economic value from not being generally known. And then finally, it's subject to efforts, reasonable efforts to maintain its secrecy. We will address today, there's been some new case law that, has addressed some new developments in, what could be information, and is, broadening it to include ideas. And especially with reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy, we've seen with new developments in technology, online networks, social media, how, what is reasonable to keep something secret may no longer be, the same as it was, 10 years ago. So going into, information, it's relatively broad of what can qualify as a trade secret, and I think Jim will discuss today the new case law that's found ideas could be protectable as trade secrets. But some of the other examples can include, formulas, the secret recipes, secret, those the codes, the recipes, for ingredients that go into, Coca-Cola or I know there was one about the English muffins, WD-40 formula, and the formulas that are kind of the common, well-known types of information that can qualify. Other types of information can include manufacturing processes, so not only know-how, but also negative know-how. So that would include not only how to do something, but what procedures, processes, operations has a company found do not work. It definitely provides an advantage because it saves the time and resources and efforts from doing something that doesn't work. Also, blueprints and engineering drawings, softwares and databases, business and marketing plan. With customer lists and customer information, sometimes a just list of customer names may not be protectable, but courts in California found those extra detailed information behind those customers, their preferences, their trends, which customers are the most profitable, what are their likes, their preferences, those can be protectable. And we'll also see, can contacts, online, LinkedIn, or other social media contacts be protected as information. This past year, we've seen, new cases protecting information such as, NFL or athletes rankings for draft prospects, compilations of, weather data. But in light of, new information or new technology, the courts are going to go back to, these four definitions, these four elements under the definition. Information not generally known, derives independent economic value, and subject to reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy. So what actually derives value? It has to be economic value, and so courts have rejected the argument that something has sentimental value or historical value or spiritual value alone. There must be some economic value, something for example that's going to give a company an economic advantage that it can monetize or capitalize. The California UTSA also recognizes that it doesn't have to be not only current actual value but also potential value. So there is the recognition of future value that could occur. Now for the third, it has to be not generally known both to the public or others that are in the industry that are knowledgeable about the subject matter, and especially those who could obtain economic value from disclosure use, including competitors who would be able to use that information for their own benefit. Now, there is a new case which Jim will discuss regarding kind of the expansion of information qualifying as a trade secret, and it specifically regards to the protection of ideas.
All right, thanks, Josh. So the case that Josh referred to is the Altavion case, and this case is useful because it helps provide some needed clarity. A case a few years back called Silvaco had some language in it that some used to suggest that an idea could not be protected as a trade secret, and rather that perhaps only patents could be used to protect ideas. So this case from 2014 makes clear, as you see from the text that we provided, that provided the trade secret is in fact kept secret, it can certainly qualify for protection and trade secret status. This is additionally useful because it does somewhat dovetail with some of the amendments to the Patent Act under the America Invents Act and some of the rules that relate to first to file. That goes beyond the subject of what we're here to talk about today, but suffice it to say that this is another tool to protect business in California if for a time a company wants to protect its intellectual property as a trade secret and then shift into a different mode and go the route of filing a patent application and enjoying the protections afforded under patent law. So this is an important decision as far as clarifying the law and providing more tools to businesses in California. Robert referred to this case that is garnering a lot of media attention. In some respects, it is a continuation of longstanding law, and that longstanding law in California is that customer lists can be, they're not always, but they can be trade secrets. and you see those cases that we've cited on this slide for that proposition. Customer list trade secrets are generally regarded on a sliding scale. The more effort that one puts into gathering the data, even if it is individually, potentially publicly available, cumulatively or in aggregate, that customer list may qualify as a trade secret. And so that's the backdrop for the cellular accessories case, wherein when presented with a summary judgment motion, ultimately the court found that LinkedIn contacts didn't say conclusively that they are, but may qualify as trade secret. And really the determination as to whether or not they may be, the court found, is going to turn at least in part on whether or not they've been made public. And there's a lot of nuance and detail into what's public or not when you're talking about social media and LinkedIn contacts in particular, but it provides a useful framework for at least informing, as of now, companies' decision-making about how they regard contacts, who has control, and user accessibility, and how they should be viewed within the organization or to the extent that individuals will control. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Robert.
Thanks, Jim. And as we continue this dialogue about how California is different as it relates to trade secret and non-compete law, we should also bear in mind, you know, the title of our program about why California is different. And, you know, part of that goes to the adoption of Business and Professions Code 16600 back in the 1870s. And I think it's part and parcel the adoption back in 1870, as well as the case law that has come up over time, making it clear that California is different and very, very much encouraging employee mobility. And so that's sort of the backdrop. And then you also have what you read in the popular press, as well as there's been some studies and scholarly literature in that as far as the success of the Silicon Valley and the employee mobility in that regard. And so a lot of people point to that as, you know, part of the reason why, you know, you have this environment of of the dot-com and technology companies very much thriving in California. Now, there's some people that don't believe that to be the case and just say that it may be fortuity, but it makes you look at the issue fairly critical. So as we go forward about how California is different, one of the key differences, definitions under the trade secret are reasonable secrecy measures. And one of the leading indicators of whether you have reasonable secrecy measures in place is whether or not you use non-disclosure agreements with your employees, your vendors, your supply side, your contractors. Don't forget people along the way that do have access to your trade secrets. Now, I'm often surprised when some clients say, well, we just use an employee handbook, or we just rely upon the employee to keep things confidential as part of their duty of loyalty. That's not a good practice. The best practice is to have a non-disclosure agreement with your employee. You can also buttress it by having it in your employee handbook, but certainly have an agreement with your employee. Other things that help demonstrate that you have reasonable secrecy measures are your computer's password protected? Do you have computer access and computer usage policies? Are they up to date with the current state of the law? Do you have email and electronic data policies? You have social media, bring your own device policies. Are all those policies focused on protecting your information? Because if they're not, they should be, because those are all efforts that you can go to point to that you have reasonable secrecy measures in place. Another key indicator is, do you limit access to trade secret information to people that need to know it? Or do you let the entire workforce have access to information that they really don't need to have access to? A common indicator is, if you have an internal network and everyone on the network is able to look at what you would consider bet the company information, that could be pointed to as not having reasonable secrecy measures in place. So it's important to be thoughtful about who gets access to what you consider to be your trade secret. And it's also important that if people are violating your non-disclosure agreements, or if people are misusing information that's prohibited under your agreements or policies, that you take action against those breaches. Because you can bet down the line, if it ever becomes contentious and the employee joins a competitor and that employee has a good memory, they'll be pointing to other instances where security was breached, information was disclosed, and the company didn't do anything about it. It's important to have regular training on the policies related to confidentiality. It shouldn't be one of those systems where when there's onboarding, they sign a non-disclosure agreement, and then when the employee leaves, they're again reminded. You need to have continual training so that employees recognize the importance of keeping company information confidential and how it derives value to the company. That, you know, their paycheck, if it's part and parcel, derives from the value that the company derives from its trade secrets and confidential information. If you can get that buy-in, you're 10 steps ahead of most companies in that regard. Again, you need to have exit interviews and document your exit interviews with interviews, as well as, you know, taking notes during the interviews, as well as asking the employee to sign an exit interview certification where they acknowledge that they're going to abide by their obligations. Courts have looked at all of these points that we're going through as evidence that that companies have used reasonable secrecy measures. And as I mentioned, it's important. Companies sometimes do a really good job of protecting their information with their employees, but as soon as they start outsourcing, using contractors, using supply-side vendors, they're not always very mindful about keeping that information protected and don't always have non-disclosure provisions in those contracts. That's an important thing to keep in mind on your checklist as you go through what type of reasonable secrecy measures your company has. Another important aspect is don't forget about the executives. Oftentimes, companies will have really good procedures in place for the run-of-the-mill employee, the sales team, research and development, but sometimes they make special rules and special exceptions for management, and that's where things can go off the tracks really quick. You'll see in this cartoon that's on the slide, this executive wants to know, you know, if he could speak at the secret new product seminar and whether that would break the confidentiality agreement. So it's important with executives that you do coaching, that you do training with them, because they're the ones that probably know some of the most important information about the company, and they need to know how important it is to keep confidentiality, particularly when they travel and how they protect their information when they're traveling, particularly if they're going to a foreign company or foreign country. They may want to have a dummy laptop that they take with them. They may not want to have their company, their regular company laptop that has all the important information on it because they're a target. It's important to note that under the case law that's been developed about reasonable secrecy measures, absolute secrecy is not required. It's just what's reasonable under the circumstances. But that can be little comfort to somebody that has their information posted on the internet or loses a contract or a significant customer as a result of a trade secret misappropriation incident. So although absolute secrecy is not required, the courts will, and the defendant will certainly scrutinize different holes in your bucket as it relates to your secrecy measures. So it can be some comfort in a lawsuit, but obviously nobody wants to really have a lawsuit. So the better protections you can put in place, the better. I think there was a recent California case that kind of illustrates where a company went wrong, and this is where there is a particular incident where had to do with a USB technology, and the prototype was shared with a business partner, and then subsequently they got the prototype and they asked someone else to manufacture the prototype. And the original manufacturer said, "Hey, we thought that this was protected. We thought that that you would keep it confidential." And they brought a trade secret misappropriation lawsuit, and the court rejected the trade secret claim, essentially saying that the plaintiff's evidence that it had taken reasonable efforts to maintain the secrecy of the trade secret was not sufficient. The bottom line is it boiled down to that prior to providing the prototype, they had never asked the business partner to sign an NDA. There had been some communications back and forth, but there had never been a John Hancock on that particular non-disclosure agreement. And so even though the defendant had told its employees to keep things confidential, that wasn't sufficient. The court was really looking for a signed agreement in order to establish that there was reasonable secrecy measures in place. With that, I will turn it over to Josh, who's going to present on misappropriation.
At a state of claim to protect your trade secrets, the California Uniform Trade Secrets Act allows for two types of misappropriation. That is the actual misappropriation and, as we previously mentioned before, threatened misappropriation. With actual misappropriation, there's kind of three primary methods that you can state a claim regarding the unlawful taking use of your trade secret information, and that is the improper acquisition, disclosure, or use. So to state a claim for misappropriation for the improper acquisition, you'd have to establish that somebody acquired the trade secret information and at that time they knew or had reason to know that it was a trade secret and that it was acquired by improper means. Or it could be established that there was a disclosure or use of that trade secret information without the consent of the trade secret holder, and improper means were used in that use or disclosure, and that can include various methods in which they knew or had reason to know that it would be protectable trade secret information, including that improper means were used to acquire it, or the person that it was acquired from had a duty to maintain secrecy or confidentiality, or before there was a material change in their position that they knew or had reason to know that that trade secret had been acquired by an accident or mistake. Now, regarding threatened misappropriation, as we previously discussed, and we'll discuss a little bit more later, California has rejected the inevitable disclosure doctrine. Other jurisdictions have adopted it or some version of it. But in California, there is the possibility of stating a claim for threatened misappropriation, and it is recognized expressly in the statute. And you can get an injunction or enjoin threatened misappropriation, and there's three primary kind of bases or grounds that you can state a claim. One, that based on past conduct of the alleged defendant, they had misused or disclosed trade secret information in the past. So there's that history, that record that would establish that there could be a threat misappropriation or future harm. Second would be that person intends to improperly use or disclose the trade secret information. Again, there would have to be evidence of an intent of that anticipated use. Or finally, that the alleged violator has wrongfully refused to return the trade secrets, and that would have to require that the trade secret holder expressly demanded or asked for the trade secret information back, and there was a refusal. And of course, seeking injunctive relief on these, it would have to show that there's this imminent harm on one of these grounds. With that, I'll turn it over to Jim, who will discuss what actually constitutes improper means to state a claim for misappropriation.
All right, thanks, Josh. So improper means, as Josh has just reviewed, is a basis upon which one can assert a misappropriation claim. I think it's a particularly important basis because in the digital age, when it isn't always easy to prove up direct use or disclosure of a trade secret, an improper means misappropriation claim can be powerful. And so it's a very broad definition of what can constitute improper, and that also provides some flexibility for trade secret plaintiffs to assert a improper means misappropriation claim. It's important to note that reverse engineering or independent derivation shall not be considered an improper means. So if you've built something that relies upon a trade secret and it hasn't been patented, and your competitor is able to take it apart and find out what in fact is the trade secret aspect of it, that is not improper means, or may not be improper means. Just a bit on the burden of proof. It really is on the plaintiff, as one might expect, and just a distinction between trade secrets and patent law. reverse engineering is not an issue for patent law where it is for a trade secret. And that's somewhat intuitive, but it's important to note when a company is looking at this potential crossroad of patent or trade secret protection and when to pull the trigger on which of those protective measures. And next few slides are just to point out what improper means sometimes looks like. It's very easy for folks, for employees, for vendors, for competitors, business partners who are falling out of a potential engagement to misappropriate data. USB drives increasingly are used, and they can be difficult to track. Cloud computing is another place where trade secrets can be directly misappropriated, or sometimes just by operator error or indifference and carelessness. There are multiple points on this diagram where someone could be syncing their iCloud at work and at home, and maybe they're not as careful as they ought to be when in a public place and using Wi-Fi. And that kind of ties in with some of what Robert had alluded to, executives traveling. They should really be mindful if they're going overseas and are in places where there may be bad actors out to get their information passively through devices. This is just another example to highlight the cloud computing aspect and the mobility of devices, as I was just pointing out. With that, I will turn it over to Robert.
Thanks, Jim. And just a reminder to the audience, feel free to send us questions. We'd love to have a question and answer session at the end of today's presentation. So briefly, on the inevitable disclosure doctrine, the general concept being that you worked for a company, you were exposed and had access to the company's trade secrets, you maybe even developed the company's trade secrets, and now you've left the company and you're going to go work for a direct competitor, and how is it that you are going to be able to work for that direct competitor and not use the trade secret or confidential information that you were exposed to? Now, in many jurisdictions, they recognize the inevitable disclosure doctrine, and they will enjoin certain competitive activity that that new employee intends to do for the new employer. California is not one of those jurisdictions, but all hope is not lost, because even though California has rejected the inevitable disclosure doctrine in the White versus Slade case, which, mind you, is only one court of appeal decision, I think it's important to know that the California Supreme Court has never weighed in on the inevitable disclosure doctrine. And so I think a lot of people like to cite, the Schlage case as, Hornbook law, that California doesn't allow the inevitable disclosure doctrine, but it's just one court of appeal decision. That being said, it is well established that California currently does not permit the inevitable disclosure doctrine. California does allow threatened misappropriation injunctions. And what that means is that similar scenario that we talked about, the application of the inevitable disclosure doctrine, but there has to be some intent. There has to be some intent showing that the employee is going to reveal those trade secrets before it's appropriate to enjoin the employee for threatened misappropriation. That could be evidence in the past that the employee has misused or disclosed a trade secret. It could be in an exit interview where the employee, in describing what he plans on doing for the competitor, says, yeah, I plan on working on the same project that I worked on for you, similar type technology. So there's more than one way to get to the result that you want, even though California hasn't expressly adopted the inevitable disclosure doctrine. Threatened misappropriation is a viable and very useful tool that can be used for that scenario where an employee just willy-nilly plans on going to a competitor and really has shown no respect for your trade secrets or confidential information. Other evidence, or other instances where the doctrine is applied, where the employee is not cooperating in returning company property and is not cooperating in exit interviews and is showing a real defiance towards honoring their non-disclosure obligations. That's another area where the the threatened misappropriation doctrine has been applied and has been effective. Another concept is oftentimes employers are a little bit confused as far as the scope of their liability. And that comes up in situations where they may hire someone from a competitor and they want to know what their potential exposure could be. And that applies to corporate shareholders, officers, and directors as well. California does not countenance this concept that you can just hire an employee and put your head in the sand and not be responsible for their conduct. If the employee is out there soliciting business for you, attempting to get business for you, and is using company trade secrets of their former employer to do so, there is no ostrich in the head defense. You are responsible for your employee's actions. Now, your lack of knowledge may go to punitive damages, and your lack of responsibility for that, or it could go to attorney's fees under the willful and malicious trade secret claim, and the company arguing that they shouldn't be on the hook for attorney's fees. But certainly there will be liability. And so that is not a good defense. You are responsible for the employees you hire and the actions they take on your behalf. And it also applies to corporate shareholders, officers, and directors under well-established California law. With that, I'll turn it over to Josh, who's going to talk about, before we get to that, one nuance of California law that's really not that remarkable, but it's worth noting because there was a recent case on it, is trade secret ownership. And a case has firmly established that in California there is no current ownership rule. And what does that mean? It means that if you sell your trade secrets, say you sell your business, you can still maintain a lawsuit for misappropriation that occurred pre-sale. Now, the best practice is obviously to have that documented in the buy-sell agreement and the accompanying documents that you have. That you maintain your rights to pursue claims for incidents that occurred pre-sale. And in this Jasmine Networks versus Superior Court case, the court made it clear that there is no current ownership rule, that a prior owner can maintain a trade secret misappropriation claim under applicable California law. Josh is going to move on to trade secret identification, which is another concept that makes California unique. In other trade secret jurisdictions, obviously you have to identify your trade secret, but California has an express statutory requirement that you identify your trade secrets prior to the commencement of discovery.
Thanks, Robert. So in California, there is a requirement under the California Uniform Trade Secrets Act that both in the complaint and prior to commencing discovery, the trade secret holder, the plaintiff, has to describe that subject matter of the trade secret with a sufficient particularity. The leading case, the Oates case, requires that there must be a description with sufficient particularity, but also is that it can separate it from just general matters in the industry, just general knowledge of the trade or just kind of general information. And so there is kind of an increased burden based on the type of information that is a trade secret, that there must be a reasonable, sufficient description. Something, for example, that's alleged to be constituted trade secrets, such as, customer information, may not have a requirement to be sufficiently described in detail as a, something regarding a complex technological device, trade secrets regarding a new engine for an electric car. So there is kind of that balance. It is kind of difficult sometimes because while a company wants to has that burden to describe it, they don't want to disclose too much or more than necessary. So there is kind of a balance of what needs to be sufficiently described. And so with the complaint, it needs to, put the defendant on notice of, what are the issues, what is the information. That way there can be, some, at the time of trial, reasonable guidance of at the training on what, the defendant needs to address or build their defenses on. One of the things that sets California apart from other jurisdictions with regard to discovery is that that trade secret information has to be described in reasonable particularity before any discovery can be commenced. And it's a significant issue, and it really helps kind of frame kind of the borders and the scope of discovery. The requirement is codified in the state statute, and in this slide, if you notice, there was a federal court that actually recognized that there's, you know, five or four primary purposes of 2019-210, which is that requirement for disclosing the trade secret information before discovery. There has been some discussion in the federal district courts of whether this particular section does apply, since it is a state statute, and whether it applies to the federal procedures of the federal courts. Some courts have found that even if it doesn't, you know, expressly apply to the federal courts, the federal procedure, that those federal courts have nonetheless applied the same purposes, the same practices and policies behind that disclosure requirement. And specifically, the ones that are discussed here is it really promotes well-invested claims. You avoid these, you know, frivolous filings, complaints that have no merit. Second, it avoids fishing expeditions where competitors are bringing a trade secret claim, having a very vague definition just so they can get discovery into what the alleged violators, that defendant's trade secrets are. It also frames the appropriate scope of discovery. And then finally, it also helps the defendants, you know, form their defenses, form, you know, a well-reasoned defense, so it's not at the eve of trial where they're still trying to scramble to see what actually the trade secrets they're alleged to have misappropriated. Now, satisfying that actual requirement, just kind of go briefly, you know, it has to be reasonable, fair, proper, just, and rational. There is that balance of, you know, you only want to disclose as much as possible without, you know, fully disclosing the entire trade secret. But there has to be, you know, those boundaries provided to permit the defendant to have an understanding of what they need to defend it for trial. With regards to that, I'll turn it over to discuss the types of remedies that can be that are available for trade secret misappropriation.
All right, thanks, Josh. We're going to just go through this pretty quickly. These are fairly standard across those jurisdictions that have adopted the USA. So really, one of the differentiators in California, and this is absent from all other jurisdictions, but is the reasonable royalty when it comes to monetary damages. And there is kind of a sliding scale here. You talk about actual damages. If that is not something that can be proven up, maybe unjust enrichment is something that can be shown. Reasonable royalty is a relatively rare instance, but it is available, and there is some limited case law on those situations in which, from a factual perspective, the misappropriation has been proven up, but because of perhaps the trade secret at issue or how it's embodied in a particular device, it may be very difficult to show the actual quantification of damages. And so in those instances, courts have, and this again is limited, but have shown that the reasonable royalty can be applied. And before we move off of this slide into the next subject matter, I wanted to read to you the CLE code for today. So let me state that now. It's SS as in Sam, so SS7468. Read that one more time. SS7468. And with that, I'll turn the slides over to Robert.
Thanks, Jim. Our next topic is preemption. And preemption is something that separates California from other jurisdictions. Now, in other jurisdictions, they do have trade secret preemption. There are some states that don't recognize trade secret preemption. In a nutshell, what trade secret preemption relates to is the concept that if someone steals your stuff, if someone steals your information, what type of claims can you bring against that individual or company that has taken your stuff? Now, in California, there is a split in authority, but the majority rule is that In those instances, in general, you would be limited to a breach of contract claim and a trade secret claim. And what you would not be able to bring would be claims for tortious interference with contract, breach of duty of loyalty, unfair competition, other common law tort claims. Now, in saying that, the focus is in the allegations that you're making on those particular claims, such as tortious interference, if the wrongful act, if the breach of duty of loyalty is the taking of your property, the taking of your information, that's where it's preempted. If you can independently show that you can establish the elements of those various torts without relying upon the theft of property or theft of information, then you're fine. The real focus is on if the gist or the nucleus of the cause of action is on the theft of information, then you can be precluded. California has a statute that deals with this issue. It tells you what's preempted and what's not preempted. It's not the most artful statute that's been drafted. It's clear under the statute, though, that criminal remedies are not preempted, nor are contractual remedies. There's well-established case law that says, however, that common law claims that are based upon the same nucleus of facts as the misappropriation trade secrets claim are preempted, and that's under California authority. Similar authority is the Sovaco decision, which affirms the preemptive effect of the preemption language in California's adoption of the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Now, some federal courts have disagreed with some of the California Court of Appeal decision, and have said parties shouldn't really have to make an election of whether they want to bring a common law claim or a trade secret claim at the inception of a lawsuit, to which the California Court of Appeal decisions have said they don't really have an election at all. They can't bring those common law claims. And so there's presently a split of authorities amongst the state and some of the federal cases. Now, some of the federal decisions are swinging towards the California state Court of Appeal way. This recent case from Judge Koh in the Northern District of California, Sun Power Corporation cases versus Solar City, the preemption doctrine was actually even expanded further. The claims pled were common law claims based upon the theft of non-trade secret information. So they were not saying that, yes, you stole our trade secrets, and as a result, we're also asserting these common law claims. They expressly said, no, they stole our information, they stole our property, they're not trade secrets, and we want to assert these common law claims as a result. Judge Koh says, no, you can't do that, that there has to be something in the positive, quote, positive law that makes that information property, that makes that information property apart from it, you know, being potentially being a trade secret. You need to point to something that says that information, that non-trade secret information, is property. And if you can't point to something that makes it property, then you cannot maintain the claim. The court also noted that you could maintain these non-trade secret claims, these common law claims, if you can allege something that's materially different. A material different wrongdoing from the wrongdoing alleged in the trade secret claim. So, it's as clear as mud from a general perspective on, you know, whether common law claims under California law are preempted when you get in front of a particular judge, what particular standard the judge is going to follow, whether they're going to follow the strict majority rule, or whether they're going to be a little bit more forgiving in allowing you to bring common law claims. I think this is really important, though, because if this majority rule continues to gain traction, you start thinking about, well, I understand that I can still bring a breach of contract claim, but now the courts are questioning whether there's a property right. And so really, what is this confidential information that you're trying to protect? Does the non-disclosure agreement itself provide you with the contract right? That would be, you know, the positive law that Judge Koh is referring to. And so what we're seeing there is some clients that are concerned about whether confidential information itself is protectable. It's quite clear that under these majority decisions that confidential information that doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret is not protectable under a tort theory under the majority rule in California. But can you still have your breach of contract claim? I think the well-reasoned view is that you should still be able to have your breach of contract claim, and that there is protectable, quote, confidential information. There is information that exists within a company that doesn't rise to a level of a trade secret that's still protectable. And so that's where I think we're going to continue to see additional activity as far as and case law trying to figure out, you know, what isn't protectable information under California law. And with that, I will turn it over to Jim, who's going to discuss briefly our next topic, which is bad faith claims of misappropriation.
All right. Thanks, Robert. So we previously mentioned that there's been some activity in the bad faith space, and I'll just jump, in the interest of time, right to that. Previously, there was a case, Fleur, in which the defendant made a claim or asserted that the plaintiff brought their claim in bad faith. Keeping in mind that a bad faith claim may stand either for bringing a claim in bad faith and or maintaining the claim in bad faith. The Fleur case turned out that the court found that the claim was brought and maintained in bad faith. So the latest development is that the plaintiff's counsel in that underlying case was itself made subject to a claim for malicious prosecution. And you've seen here on this slide the bullet points in which the court found that the bad faith in the underlying action served as evidence in the malicious prosecution claim to allow that case or that claim against the plaintiff's counsel in Fleur to stand. And so this, in some respects, ups the ante yet further when companies are tempted to, and frankly their counsel, who are enabling them to bring a claim, that they really do need to go into it with their eyes wide open and understand the legal parameters as best they can as to what facts are known, available, and needed to further prove up their claim and proceed with appropriate caution. With that, I'll turn the slide back over to Josh.
Thanks, Jim. We'll go into the one thing that really sets California apart from other jurisdictions, as we fully discussed, is its policy towards non-competition agreements and restrictive covenants. We've seen it codified in Section 16600, Business and Professions Code. That California does have a strong public policy against non-competition agreements and really in favor of employee mobility and the employee mobility and competition. So actually, what is a non-competition agreement? This is usually the subject of some litigation because not all agreements will actually say, you know, non-compete or non-competition, but may necessarily have provisions that have the effect of being non-competitive. And so those type of agreements could include expressly prohibiting or limiting competition, but also if there's a penalty or forfeiture for compensation if that individual ultimately does compete. Two provisions that have kind of been subject to recent scrutiny are both prohibits on solicitation of customers and the solicitation of employees. We'll discuss that later today. There is some case law that has found that solicitation of customers could be potentially enforceable when it is to protect trade secret information. And then second, the prohibition on the solicitation of employees has come under some increased scrutiny. There is some California case law recognizing that anti-rating provisions could be enforceable, but provisions that prohibit the hiring of employees may not. And also in regards to the business-to-business atmosphere, when there's agreements between two companies that may have the effect of prohibiting the solicitation of employees, even though that contract's between the companies and not the employees, if it has the effect of restricting that employee mobility, those could be void under 16600. And so as we discussed, the policy behind it, why California differs, is that strong public policy towards employee mobility. We've seen there's only two other jurisdictions, and maybe Montana and South Dakota, that have similar bans on non-competes. This past year, we saw Massachusetts was potentially moving toward kind of similar restrictions. And so regarding who's kind of susceptible to this, it includes companies who have agreements that are conducting business in California, but it also courts have upheld, avoided these agreements when that company is out of the state, out of California, but is hiring employees within California. There's at least, I think, one case where the employee was not yet a California resident, but was being hired and would be ultimately moving and working and becoming a California employee with that new employer. There have been some exceptions under California's statute. California has rejected the kind of narrow restraint exception. Other jurisdictions have allowed non-competes to the extent it is narrowly tailored. It's a narrow restraint, for example, limited in geography, limited in scope and time. California, in the Edwards-Anderson case, did reject that. However, there are some exceptions both under the statute and case law that Jim will discuss.
Thanks, Josh. So we're running up against time a little bit, but I think we'll be able to wrap this up in the next 5 minutes. So I think an important concept to understand is that even though California has 16600, there are exceptions to 16600 that allow non-competition agreements. I think the general rule of thumb in California is obviously non-competition agreements with employees are generally not enforceable. Non-solicitation of customer provisions are generally not enforceable. Non-solicitation of employee provisions are typically enforceable. And obviously non-disclosure and intervention assignment agreements are enforceable. But the devil's always in the details, and there can be no real, bright line. But those are some of the general parameters. So it's important to note that if it is a sale of a business, it's a dissolution or a withdrawal from a partnership, the dissolution or termination of an interest in an LLC, those are instances where California does permit non-compete agreements and related restrictive covenant agreements. Those restrictions still must be reasonable in terms of geography, temporal, and restrictive scope. An important case that came out within the last 2 years is the Philpoint case. A typical scenario, someone sells their business and asks one of the key employees, who also is the seller of the business, to enter into a non-compete agreement. Now here, in this particular case, they actually asked them to enter into two non-compete agreements. One in the actual buy-sell of the company, and then a separate employment agreement. And that's where the train got off the tracks, because what the court found there is that it didn't make sense to have a separate non-compete agreement contained in an employment agreement, but rather you had already got the benefit of your bargain for the exchange of goodwill within the buy-sell agreement. So you're essentially double dipping for two separate non-compete agreements, and the court found it very quickly got to the conclusion that it was unenforceable. There was no justifiable exception, even though this was in the context of a buy-sell agreement. The company had already gotten a 3-year non-compete as part of the buy-sell. The employee had stayed on and then later left. And then they tried to sue under the non-compete agreement contained in the employment agreement, and the court found that there was no exception that applied, that the sale of business exception had already been used for the purchase agreement. So one thing that's often debated in California is whether there is a justifiable basis for a non-compete agreement with employees, particularly high-level employees, under the trade secret exception. And that's an unresolved issue. The California Supreme Court has not weighed in on that issue. It did not address the issue in the Arthur Anderson case. And there has been some recent case authority indicating that there is a trade secret exception. Now, it's obviously not one of your strongest arguments in your quiver, but there is some case law and some justification that a restrictive covenant can be justified under the trade secret exception. And that was demonstrated in a recent case, the Pyro Spectaculars case, in which it was a clear case of data theft, misappropriation of trade secrets, but there was also a contract involved. And what the court did there in looking at the various interests involved is they actually issued a preliminary injunction prohibiting the employee from contacting some of the customers that they previously serviced as a prophylactic measure for the wrongful acts that the employee had conducted. So when you're crafting your injunction and trying to get a restrictive covenant agreement, if you have a scenario where there's egregious facts of data theft, of misappropriation of trade secrets, you can get that type of restrictive covenant that the business really wants to get the employee from going after customers. In certain instances, California courts have entered those type of injunctions. With that, I'll let Jim conclude our program, and hopefully we have a few minutes for some Q&A.
All right. Thanks, Robert. I'll move quickly through this next set of slides. We have just a few more to go through. The upshot is this, is that over the last few years in California, there has been a trend that has emerged in which particularly federal district courts, when faced with a suit that, for instance, seeks declaratory relief, that is a declaration that a non-compete provision is unenforceable, the courts are looking at forum selection clauses in these agreements. And instead of reaching the issue of choice of law, they go straight to the forum selection clause and say, look, I don't need to reach this thornier issue of conflicts of law analysis and public policy and how that impacts California businesses. This is a valid forum selection clause, and I'm going to transfer this action based on the motion of the defendant here. And oftentimes there are competing lawsuits in a different jurisdiction. So this most frequently arises in either motions to dismiss or motions to transfer in California. And so this has been happening for the last handful of years, but has really gained steam over the last couple. And in particular, at the end of last year, there was the Atlantic Marine Construction case decided in December of 2013, which is starting to find its way into district court decisions. And the upshot is that that was in the context of a party that had brought a 12B3 motion to dismiss, and the court said, no, wait a minute, this is really something that's more appropriate for a 1404A analysis. And in the court's analysis, it basically said, look, factually in that case, there wasn't a dispute as to the validity of the forum selection clause. And so from that factual predicate, the court went on to say, look, we're going to presume that this forum selection clause is valid, and once one presumes that, this really should be, that is, this action should be transferred to the form in which the contract says it must be applied. And these questions of choice of law and whose law is going to apply will be decided by the transferor court, whose law should apply. So the transferee court will not, its law won't apply. And really what this boils down to is the court also said, look, in doing that analysis, that is the transfer and what historically has been done in weighing whether or not the transfer is appropriate, there are private interest factors and public interest factors that the court has analyzed. And we don't have time to go into that today, but the Atlantic Marine Court said, we're going to presume the forum selection clause is valid under these facts. We're going to also presume that the private interest factors are met, and you, transferee court, shouldn't even consider them. And so really all that there's left to consider are the public interest factors, which the court said rarely will those stop a action from being transferred pursuant to a valid forum selection clause. So in the interest of time, I won't go further into it, but this is an important area that's developing in California law that's being watched very closely to see if at any point a California court will step in to say, look, we understand this is the Supreme Court, but there are some public policy considerations here that we need to address first.
Thanks, Jim. We have a few questions. One question for you, Jim, is under California trade secret law, is reverse engineering allowed, or could that be a basis for a trade secret misappropriation claim?
Right. So in the normal course of things, reverse engineering is allowed. It is as long as there's not some independent unlawful activity around obtaining the information. If one is simply reverse engineering under trade secret law, that is a viable defense.
Another quick question, just one for Josh. What is the typical duration of an enforceable non-solicitive employee provision under California law?
Usually in California law, we've seen about 1 year, pretty reasonable. And so that's usually, 1 year is usually the best kind of conservative, most enforceable time.
Another quick question we have is, have we seen any attacks on non-disclosure agreements under the guise of 16600, essentially saying a non-disclosure agreement is a disguised non-compete agreement? And yeah, we have seen some challenges there, and that's why employers need to be very careful in how they draft their non-disclosure agreements, because if you're trying to protect publicly available information and your definition of confidential information is overly broad and includes public information and doesn't have specific exceptions for whistleblower activity and cooperating with government and investigation, you can be subject to an attack on overbreadth grounds as well as on grounds that it violates business and profession 16600. So it's always important to have your agreement reviewed to make sure it's not too overly broad and that you're not trying to overreach too much. With that, I think we're going to conclude today's presentation. Thanks so much for joining us. The slides will be available. You will be given a copy of the slide deck, as well as some tips coming out of today's presentation. Our next program, to conclude our trade secret webinar series this year, will be in early December, and it'll be about how to effectively use non-disclosure, non-compete agreements, as well as invention assignment agreements in various business transactions. So if that's something that touches your workload on a daily basis, feel free to sign up for that webinar. Thanks again for joining us.
And this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.